So the title of my talk today is Rights and Burdens, Can a Feminist Be Pro-Life? And I thought I would tell you a little bit about how I arrived at this question before I kind of dive into the talk. Many of you probably remember a couple years ago with the inauguration of President Trump, there was women marched across the United States, particularly Washington, D.C., for a variety of reasons, but in kind of a show of solidarity for women. And one of the things that happened prior to that march was that a number of pro-life feminist organizations wanted to join in the so-called Women's March. And initially they were accepted as co-sponsors of the event. And then for whatever reason, a couple days before the actual march, the march organizers rescinded the co-sponsorship of the pro-life feminist organizations. And this sparked, I don't know if you remember, but this sparked a lot of editorials, a lot of discussion throughout the United States about whether this was fair, whether this was legitimate, and it sparked a lot of conversation about whether or not a feminist could be a feminist and also be pro-life. And at that time, I said to my friend, Joe Capizzi, who I understand is on your list of speakers as well, I said, hey, we're the Catholic University of America, we should be talking about this, like we should bring pro-choice feminists and pro-life feminists and we should like have them talk about whether a feminist can be pro-life. And he said, that's awesome, that's a great idea, Angela, organize it. And so I did. And I had a funny experience moderating the discussion that I ended up moderating. because in the process of moderating that discussion, I felt like I understood the viewpoint, I didn't agree with it, but I understood the viewpoint of the pro-choice feminists really well. But I didn't find that I was understanding the viewpoint of the pro-life feminists as well. And that kind of made me question a lot of things in my own mind. And the result of that questioning is the paper that I'm about to read to you here tonight. So I'm just gonna start over now and read the paper from the beginning, but that's some kind of background information about what generated these thoughts. In January of 2016, women marched in locations throughout the United States, but primarily in Washington, D.C., to protest the inauguration of Donald Trump. The organizers of what became known as the Women's March made a deliberate attempt to be inclusive. They envisioned a march for all women, a march that welcomed women of every race and creed. Perhaps with this goal of inclusivity in mind, they initially allowed a wide variety of groups, including pro-life feminist groups, to co-sponsor the event. But then, just days before the event, March organizers revoked the co-sponsorship of pro-life feminist organizations. This sparked a national conversation. If feminism is really as inclusive as it claims to be, if the goals of feminism truly do transcend race and creed and culture, then can't a feminist also be pro-life? My initial reaction, the reaction of someone well outside the fray, was that the answer was obvious and the question was insulting. Of course a feminist can be pro-life, I thought. But in 2016, I knew about as much about feminism as I know about the temperance movement, and I thought of both in roughly the same way. In the way one thinks about battles that were fought and decided a long time ago. In the ensuing years, I thought more about this question. I understand a very little bit more about feminism, and I understand a bit more about why feminists argue that one cannot be both a feminist and oppose abortion. And my more nuanced understanding leads me to a more nuanced point of view. Yes, one can be a feminist and oppose abortion. But being pro-life is going to constrain and set limits on your feminism and perhaps redefine it altogether, because being pro-life means ascribing to a moral framework that constrains and sets limits on and redefines everything. The goal of the present paper is to explain how I arrived at this conclusion. In what follows, I'm first going to explain why some feminists see an intimate connection between the attainment of the goals of feminism and access to abortion. I'm going to focus on two different kinds of arguments, which I'll call the motive argument and the burden argument. I will argue that the motive argument, even if true, falls far short of establishing a necessary connection between access to abortion and attainment of the goals of feminism. The burden argument, however, does pose a real challenge to those who both support the aims of feminism and oppose abortion. I will argue that although contemporary pro-life feminists have attempted to respond to the burden argument, their response falls short in important ways. Finally, I will propose a way forward. So that's what I'm going to do, but before I do it, I want to make two disclaimers. First, what I want to talk about here is the possibility of pro-life feminism and not the morality of abortion. This is important because there are lots of ways of arguing for or against abortion. But some feminists, both pro-choice and pro-life, want to make a very specific claim, namely that the goals of feminism in and of themselves necessitate a conclusion about whether legal access to abortion is a good or a bad thing. Pro-choice feminists believe that access to safe and legal abortion is essential to the attainment of the goals of feminism. Pro-life feminists disagree. Indeed, some pro-life feminists go even further and insist that abortion is antithetical to the goals of feminism. So that's the claim that I want to discuss here tonight. Second, I want to acknowledge at the outset the difficulties inherent in any attempt to describe the feminist position on anything. If you look up feminism in the dictionary, you'll read that feminism is a movement that seeks the political, social, and economic equality of women. And that sounds well and good until you try to pin down what the social, political, and economic equality of women would consist in. There's no canonical way of answering those questions, and indeed, given the many and various answers, it would in some sense be more accurate to refer to feminisms than to feminism. However, I think it is fair to say that all feminists believe that there is gender inequality and that it should be eliminated, even if they disagree about what the inequality consists in and how it should be eliminated. The feminist arguments for the necessity of abortion rights that I will consider here can be construed broadly enough to incorporate different ways of answering that question. Okay, so first I'm going to talk about what I take to be the easy argument, namely the motive argument. When Alabama's recent abortion regulations were signed into law, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez unleashed a series of tweets which claimed that the new regulations were about owning women. Ocasio-Cortez alleged, among other things, that Alabama's regulations were no more than an attempt by religious fundamentalists to, quote, outlaw sex that falls outside their theology. Ocasio-Cortez's tweets are illustrative of a common feminist argument, namely that opposition to abortion is nothing more than a smokescreen for an attempt to control women and keep them in their place. This argument, which I will call the motive argument, maintains that opponents of abortion are not actually motivated by concern for the unborn at all, but simply want to police women's lives. As I will show in what follows, the evidence cited in support of the motive argument is shaky at best. The real problem, however, is that the motive argument, even if true, does nothing to establish a necessary connection between the attainment of the goals of feminism and access to abortion. Those who argue that abortion restrictions are at heart only an attempt to police female behavior and keep women in their place offer three different arguments in support of their claim. First, opposition to abortion correlates closely with social conservatism. Opponents of abortion, so the argument goes, tend to be religious, vote Republican, and favor traditional gender roles. And this would seem to indicate that opposition to abortion is not an independent position, but something that stems from other views, and particularly from views about the proper role of women and notions about how a good mother should behave. Second, advocates of the motive argument point out that views about the acceptability of abortion tend to shift dramatically depending on a woman's reason for seeking it. A 2018 Gallup poll, for instance, reported that while 77% of US adults believe that abortion should be legal in cases of rape or incest, only 45% believe that abortion should be legal in cases where the child is simply unwanted. Pro-choice feminists argue that this inconsistency reveals that opposition to abortion does not really stem from concern for the child at all, but from judgments about the behavior of the woman seeking the abortion. When the woman is perceived as the guiltless victim, they argue, there is support for her decision to end a pregnancy. But when the woman is perceived as selfish, as putting her wants and needs first, then her decision to end the pregnancy is viewed unfavorably. Pro-choice feminists argue that if opponents of abortion were really concerned for the well-being of the fetus, then they would oppose it regardless of the woman's motive. Finally, supporters of the motive argument claim that anti-abortion legislation is primarily aimed at punishing women who seek abortions and not at helping unborn children. If legislators were truly concerned about the well-being of unborn children, then one would expect them to pass laws that would assist pregnant women and which would continue to help the child once that child was born. Since anti-abortion legislators seemingly have no interest in pursuing such legislation, advocates of the motive argument conclude that they cannot really be motivated by concern for the child at all. Now, I think all three of these arguments are problematic in their own right. The first argument, in addition to making a sweeping generalization, assumes that correlation is causation. The mere fact that someone is, say, politically conservative and opposed to abortion is no evidence that her political conservatism caused her opposition to abortion. Even if it were, it is not at all clear that opponents of abortion are exclusively Republican, religious, and socially conservative. A 2016 Slate article entitled "The New Culture of Life" proclaimed that the future of the pro-life movement is young, female, secular, and feminist. The article follows several pro-life groups, groups such as Secular Pro-Life and New Wave Feminists, which are not only vibrant and growing, but whose membership does not neatly correlate with traditional stereotypes. Now, I think the second argument is actually more convincing, because it points to a genuine contradiction in popular opinion. Belief about the morality of abortion changes based on details about how the child was conceived. But if abortion is murder, then the details of conception should be irrelevant. It will be as murderous to kill a child conceived by rape as it is to kill a child conceived in any other way. But popular opinions are not always consistent. Many of those who oppose the targeting of civilians in warfare, for instance, also say that the United States' decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima was a good one. Many of those who oppose torture nonetheless say that they would support its use in dramatic ticking time bomb or ticking bomb scenarios. It is thus possible, even probable, that many of those who oppose abortion in general, but not in the case of rape or incest, either have conflicting moral intuitions or else think of extreme situations as a sort of moral paradox. That they think it is still wrong to kill the child, but also unjust to ask the woman to carry her attacker's child. Finally, it is unclear what legislative attempts to restrict abortion imply about the motives of those who introduce them. It is not at all clear to me that existing legislative attempts to restrict abortion actually do exclusively focus on punishing the women who seek them. laws requiring a waiting period, or that the mother be fully informed, or that parents be notified of an underage daughter's choice, do not seem to me to be particularly punitive. But even supposing the case can be made, it is possible that those who favor such measures are simply motivated by the desire to put an end to what they perceive as an injustice. It is easier and cheaper to move to stop injustices than it is to treat the roots of a problem, and it may well be the case that opponents of abortion simply wish to use the easiest and most readily available measures. But none of that is the most important point. The most important point to be made about the motive argument is that it does nothing whatsoever to demonstrate a necessary connection between feminism and abortion rights. The motive argument, if successful, would show only that those who currently oppose abortion are motivated by an attempt to oppress women. It would not show that any and all opposition to abortion must be motivated by an attempt to oppress women. Many contemporary pro-life feminists, for instance, explicitly separate themselves from the religious and political affiliations traditionally associated with the pro-life movement. They agree that abortion legislation should not be punitive and that attempts to reduce abortion should focus on measures aimed at helping women and children. If a case is to be made that the attainment of the goals of feminism necessitates access to abortion, something stronger than the motive argument is going to have to be offered. So now I want to examine one such argument, which I'm going to call the burden argument. And I want to argue that this argument actually does pose a real challenge to the feminist who wishes to oppose abortion. And it's a challenge that contemporary pro-life feminists have not done a very good job of responding to. In her famous essay, A Defense of Abortion, Judith Jarvis Thompson compares what a mother does when she carries and gives birth to a child to the biblical story of the Good Samaritan. In the biblical story, a traveler, the Samaritan, comes upon a stranger who has been attacked and left for dead. Although he has no particular investment in the stranger, nor any reason to be concerned for him, the stranger drops everything to care for the wounded stranger. When a woman becomes pregnant and carries the child to term, Thompson argues, she is being that good Samaritan. She is voluntarily giving her own resources to sustain the life of another, often at great personal cost. The Samaritan's selflessness, says Thompson, is certainly admirable and praiseworthy, but it is not something that society typically demands of its members. Indeed, she claims there's only one group in society of whom Good Samaritan is not merely expected, but demanded: pregnant women. Society demands that pregnant women put their lives on hold and endure discomfort and even danger for the sake of the child they carry. But society demands no such sacrifices of its other members, not even when the sacrifices are much smaller. And this, Thompson argues, is unfair. Now, Thompson's argument exemplifies a certain kind of strategy, which I'm going to call the burden argument. The burden argument asserts that, one, pregnancy is burdensome, that, two, the burdens of pregnancy are borne primarily by women, and that, three, any society that burdens a subset of its members in a disproportionate way is guilty of an injustice. Since pregnancy is burdensome, and since legislation that restricts or prohibits abortion prevents women from opting out of the burden of pregnancy, it follows on this argument that a society that restricts or prohibits abortion is a society that treats women unjustly. So, in what follows, I want to examine this argument, and particularly I want to examine the ways in which feminists who oppose abortion have tried to respond to it. I first want to argue that it, unlike the motive argument, is not at all irrelevant. A feminist who opposes abortion must find some way of responding to it. I will then argue that although feminists who oppose abortion have tried to respond to the burden argument, they have not done so well. And finally, I will propose a way forward. So as I formulated it, the burden argument consists of three claims and a conclusion. Although some will want to reject the first claim outright, namely that pregnancy is burdensome, I think there is good ground to concede it, at least on a certain understanding of burden. The word burden can sometimes be taken to mean bad. When someone says, I don't want to be a burden, the implication is something of this sort. A burden is a dead weight with no positive value. A parasite that sucks the life out of its host. But there is no need to understand burden in this way. If burden is simply taken at face value, namely as a difficult undertaking, then a great many things, including very valuable things, are burdensome. Friends are burdensome, families are burdensome, political office is burdensome. Indeed, one might even say that in many cases, the more valuable the undertaking, the more burdensome it will be. More importantly, although some feminists, Simone de Beauvoir in particular, really do seem to understand childbearing in a particularly negative way, not all feminists do. And if we can attribute a more charitable understanding of burden to the burden argument, then we should do so. If burden is merely taken to mean difficult undertaking, then the first two claims, that pregnancy is burdensome and that the burdens of pregnancy are primarily borne by women, are not really up for dispute. Pregnancy is burdensome. For some women, it is very burdensome, even a threat to life and health. For other women, it is less burdensome. But one needn't work through laundry lists of things pregnant women experience to agree with the main point. Pregnancy is hard and difficult, and it is a hardship that directly affects only women. The truth of the third claim, namely that any society that burdens some subset of its members in a disproportionate way is guilty of an injustice, is far from obvious. Life is burdensome, and the burdens of life are not, in general, fairly distributed. It is not obvious that a society does something wrong when it asks different subsets of society to handle different burdens. Healthy young people are expected to bear the burden of fighting for their country. The employed are expected to bear the burden of helping to care for those who are not employed. And the list goes on. An adequate defense of the third claim would take a considerable amount of work. That work cannot be done here, but it's also not necessary. Because feminism, by its very definition, seems to be already committed to at least some version of the third claim. Even understood in the most general terms, feminism is a movement that seeks to bring about equality between the sexes. This needn't commit feminism to any particular views about how social groups in general should be treated. A feminist can certainly hold, for instance, that the young and the healthy should be burdened with their country's defense, or that the healthy and the able can be justifiably burdened with the care of the sick and the disabled. But feminism, by its very definition, does seem to be committed to at least a restricted version of the third claim. The feminist at least seems to hold that any society that burdens women in a disproportionate way is guilty of an injustice. For the feminist believes that unequal treatment of women is an injustice, and demanding that women bear a disproportionate burden is at least a prima facie kind of unequal treatment. So all of this is just to clarify the point I asserted at the outset. The feminist who also opposes abortion does indeed need to find a way of responding to the burden argument. Feminists who oppose abortion already agree that pregnancy imposes special burdens on women, and they already agree that society is obligated to implement measures to alleviate those burdens. It is this recognition that is behind their advocacy of measures such as paid maternity leave, health care, and other measures aimed at helping women bear and care for their children. If they also insist that one way of removing the burden should not be on the table, then they need to explain how that insistence is compatible with their feminism. For if a feminist, someone whose stated goal is to eliminate gender inequality, insists that an unequal burden must sometimes be borne, then it is incumbent on her to explain herself. What is feminist about insisting that women see the burdensome task of childbearing through? Now, pro-life feminists commonly respond by arguing that it is not the child itself that is burdensome, but other aspects of pregnancy. Women want the child, they argue, but they are forced into seeking abortion because society fails to sufficiently support them. Frederica Matthews Green, former vice president of Feminists for Life, has famously argued that abortion is always an act of desperation on the woman's part. Like an animal caught in a trap trying to gnaw off its own leg, says Matthews Green, a woman who seeks abortion is trying to escape a desperate situation by an act of violence and self-loss. Abortion, she claims, is not a sign that women are free, but a sign that they are desperate. Rebecca Bratton Weiss, co-founder of New Pro-Life, says that, quote, abortion happens because pre-existing injustices force women into intolerable situations, and the New Wave Feminist website, declaring that no woman ever wants to have an abortion, states that its aim is to make abortion unthinkable by making abortion unnecessary. So the pro-life feminist response to the burden argument seems to be that it is not the child itself that women find burdensome, but the cold, cruel world in which some pregnant women find themselves. That women choose abortion only because they find themselves in an intolerable and oppressive situation from which abortion seems like the only escape. Some are pressured into choosing abortion by family members or partners. Others see no way to carry the child and keep their job, or keep their child in care for existing children, or etc. Abortion, on this argument, is always an unhappy and tragic compromise between what the woman really wants to keep her child and the necessities of life. The truly feminist response, the pro-life feminist argues, would be to give women the help they need so they are not forced to choose something they don't want in the first place. The side effect of doing so will be that abortion is no longer a problem. So the pro-life feminist agrees that women shouldn't be unfairly burdened. She just denies that abortion is a burden-alleviating option that women really want. Now, the claim that no woman wants an abortion has superficial appeal, but I think that's important to consider it carefully. What does the feminist opponent of abortion actually mean when she claims that no woman wants an abortion? Want is a funny word. In one sense, in the way that no one wants to have a cavity filled or pay taxes or any other unpleasant thing, it is trivially true that no woman wants to have an abortion. In one sense, I don't want to have my cavity filled. It's painful, it's time consuming, it's generally unpleasant, and so on. But in another sense, I very much do want to have my cavity filled. Given the choice between living with the cavity and having it filled, I would choose the filling again and again and again. If pro-life feminists are using the word want in the same way I use it, when fully intending to do it and fully believing it would be the best option, I nonetheless say that I don't want to have my cavity filled, then I think their claim that no woman wants to have an abortion is true, but uninteresting. But pro-life feminists clearly aren't using want in this trivially true way. Because one can concede the trivially true sense and still think that abortion is an option that women need to have. So they must mean something more robust. They must mean that women have abortions unwillingly, that they are forced into it, and that they are forced into it because we as a society have failed to give them the kind of support they need. Things like health care and maternity leave. This, we can all agree, is true of many women who choose abortion, and we can all agree that it is a scandal. But pro-life feminists seem to be making this claim about all abortions and all women. They seem to be claiming that no woman sees the child itself as a burden, that it is only the necessities of life that are burdensome and which sometimes force her, with greatest reluctance, to end her child's life. The most obvious problem with a response like this is that it is false. It assumes that every woman, when she finds out she is pregnant, is delighted and eager to bring that child into the world if only she could find a way. And that if she ever chooses otherwise, it is only out of desperation. And that, as one pro-choice feminist derisively put it, is something your sweet old Aunt Sally would say. My discontent with this kind of answer crystallized for me in the summer of 2016, when news networks covered Olympian Sanya Richard Ross's biography. In that biography, Richard Ross reveals that she chose to have an abortion, a decision which she says broke her. Shortly before the 2008 Olympic Games, Richard Ross discovered she was pregnant. She was engaged to be married and is now married, and both she and her fiancé, the child's father, wanted children. But carrying her child to term would mean a missed spot at the Olympics, a goal she had spent a lifetime trying to achieve. Richard Ross was at the top of her game, and missing the 2008 Olympics might mean losing her one chance at an Olympic medal. She had an abortion the day before she left for the Olympics. Now, we can blame Richard Ross's abortion on many things, but we simply cannot claim that her child just died because of something society failed to provide. Richard Ross represents the supreme triumph of feminism. In what way could we change society so that choices like hers don't have to happen? Should we cancel the Olympics? Richard Ross made a genuinely hard, terrible choice, a choice no one wants to make. But it was her choice. She chose between the plan she always had for her life, a plan where children came after her chance for the Olympics, and the unforeseen contingency that life put in front of her. She chose her hopes and dreams. This happens. It happens when the choice has to do with something far less glorious than Olympic gold. Women with Ivy League degrees and glamorous careers, with supportive families and husbands and plenty of financial resources, sometimes have abortions. They have them because they're not ready for the sacrifices a child requires, or because they value their independence, or. The list goes on. Women have abortions because they lack jobs and healthcare and support. But they have them for other reasons too. And I think it is absolutely vital for the pro-life movement to acknowledge that. So why do I care so much about this? Why does it matter so much to me that the pro-life feminist argument doesn't accurately describe all abortions? We could argue about numbers. Some people claim that as many as 78% of all abortions are chosen for socioeconomic reasons. The studies I've seen report somewhat different numbers. The most informative study I've seen, one which reviewed official state statistics across America, found that women report economic hardship as their primary motivation in only 20 to 40% of abortions. A whopping 48% said they chose abortion because they felt unready for motherhood, or else didn't want the lifestyle changes it would require. That study also found that the numbers of so-called hardship abortions reported by places like the Guttmacher Institute are inflated by as much as 4 times the actual amount. So much as I favor offering pregnant women the support they need, I doubt that fixing our country's social woes would really diminish abortion rates by that much. But even if the numbers panned out differently, the pro-life feminist response to the burden argument would still irritate me at a visceral level. Why? Because I think it's sentimental. And I think it encourages a sentimental view of women and the choices we make. A few weeks ago, I was in an Uber, and my Uber driver started telling me about her unplanned pregnancy. She was 17, a recent immigrant, friendless, bullied by the other teens in her apartment complex. The child's father disappeared when she told him of her pregnancy, and her family, who had dreams for her, pressured her to have an abortion. I said no, she said. I told them, you never killed me, and I'm not going to kill my baby. It didn't do anything. And so instead, she radically changed her life, driving an Uber during the day and attending school at night, determined to do what she needed to do to support her son. In a completely different example, another woman, very different from my Uber driver, told a group of us at a party about finding out she was pregnant with her fourth child. I cried for a month, she said. Her other three children were older. She felt that she was finally beginning to emerge from the fog of motherhood, just beginning to find a little time for herself. To find she was pregnant again was to see all of that suddenly slip away, back out of reach. But for her, as for my Uber driver, abortion was unthinkable. And so she cried for a month. And then she dried her eyes and welcomed her child and went on with her life. Both of these women, each in very different ways, found pregnancy burdensome. Neither of them considered abortion. Economic considerations were not determinative in either case. So why did they accept the burden? I think the answer is simple. They accepted the burden because it was clear to them that it was the right thing to do. Each set aside her own plans and goals and hopes and dreams, not because they were unimportant, but because they recognized those wishes and plans were less important than the lives of the children they were carrying. Now, I see no problem saying that these women made the right decision. But I can easily see why one would think that theirs was not a particularly feminist decision. Indeed, one can easily see their decisions as the opposite of feminism. These women set aside their aspirations, feminist and otherwise, for the sake of something they considered more important. Some pro-life feminists would disagree with me on this point. Pro-life feminists sometimes argue that the moral framework mentioned above, the view that the fetus is a child and valuable and worth whatever sacrifices bearing it entails, is itself central to, and indeed essential to, feminism. The clearest version of this claim is made by Sarah Foster, the former president of Feminists for Life. Feminism, says Foster, is a philosophy that embraces basic rights for all human beings without exception, without regard to race, religion, sex, size, age, location, disability, or parentage. Feminism, says Foster, rejects the use of force to dominate, control, or destroy anyone. Since abortion involves the destruction of human beings, Foster argues, it follows that abortion is antithetical to the aims of feminism, and that a true feminist could never support abortion. So, on Foster's account, my Uber driver and my friend at the party were not setting aside their feminism, but fulfilling it. I think there's something important here, but I also think it's confusing. The problem is that it is not at all obvious that feminism actually is, quote, a philosophy that embraces basic rights for all human beings without exception. Feminism asserts something rather narrow. There should be equality between the sexes. How does that narrow view necessitate a conclusion about the inherent value of every human being? Consider something equally narrow, like patriotism. Patriotic people believe that one ought to honor and love one's country. But one can think that one ought to love one's country without thinking that one also ought to love other countries, let alone that one ought to love the inhabitants of other countries. It certainly can be said, and has been said, that a true patriot would not, say, bomb Hiroshima. But plenty of others have said that a true patriot would and should bomb Hiroshima. The question of who is correct is important, and indeed all important, but we can't settle it by looking more closely at the definition of patriotism. When we look at the evidence that Foster cites in support of her claim that feminism is, quote, a philosophy that embraces rights for all human beings without exception, we find that it is not feminism itself that Foster points to, but to the other moral views that some early feminists espoused. To the fact that Mary Wollstonecraft and Elizabeth Cady Stanton opposed abortion, to the fact that Lucretia Mott and others were abolitionists, and so on. But plenty of other feminists have held opposite views. Some feminists have been racist, some have supported eugenics, and some, like Simone de Beauvoir, considered the fetus to be a parasite. A commitment to female equality is, as it turns out, compatible with a wide variety of other views. So I began by asking whether one can be a feminist and pro-life. And I've been arguing that while many feminist ideals are compatible with opposition to abortion, the burden argument seems to pose a problem that pro-life feminists have not adequately answered. To oppose abortion is to believe that women are ethically required to accept the burden of pregnancy, even when that burden conflicts with things that feminists have traditionally valued, like careers and freedom. One can certainly say that given the broader moral framework in which one operates, one is ethically required to take on such burdens. But it seems more difficult to argue that it is feminist to think that one ought to take on such burdens. So I want to conclude by proposing a way forward. In one sense, the pro-life feminist's problem is easily solved. The pro-life feminist can say that when she says a true feminist must oppose abortion, she means what an advocate of just war theory means when she says a true patriot would not bomb Hiroshima even to save her country. Namely, that feminism, like patriotism, is something that must be pursued and can only be pursued within a broader moral framework, and that it is no gain for feminism if some of its goals are achieved in ways that violate that broader moral framework. I think this is a good answer, and I think it is a correct answer, but I also think it will not fully satisfy the feminist opponent of abortion, any more than it would fully satisfy a patriot who believes that wars should be just wars. Because what such a patriot actually believes is not that sometimes her moral framework requires her to be unpatriotic, but that her moral framework informs the very meaning of patriotism. She thinks that refusing to bomb Hiroshima exhibits true devotion to her country. Similarly, the feminist opponent of abortion doesn't merely think that there are moral limits on her feminism. She thinks that she supports women best by saying they should not terminate their pregnancies. A response that would fully satisfy the feminist opponent of abortion would have to unpack that belief. So I'm going to conclude with some thoughts about what a response like that might look like. When I introduced the burden argument, I pointed out that burden need not be understood in a derogatory way. Life's greatest and most important undertakings are all burdensome, and they are arguably burdensome in proportion to their importance. Two things are true of undertakings that are both burdensome and vitally important. First, when only a select group of people are capable of bearing a vitally important burden, we do not see any injustice in asking them to bear it. Second, in such instances, we do not tend to see those who are asked to bear the burden for the rest of us as slaves or drudges. We see them as heroes. If you look back to the way American society viewed young men drafted to fight in World War II, you see this. Young people on their way to war were celebrated and feted because they were taking on a great burden for the rest of us. They weren't asked to go to war because they weren't valued or because they were simply perceived as cannon fodder. Far to the contrary. They represented the best that our country had to offer, all of our promise, and we still asked it of them. Ask isn't even the appropriate word. because the draft was compulsory. It was asked and expected of them, but we still considered them to be heroes because everyone understood the importance of their sacrifice. And everyone understood that they did it for all of us. Now, it probably does not need to be said that our society does not view childbearing and rearing as a vitally important task, and that it does not see women who engage in that task as heroes. The case seems rather to be the opposite. Having traveled a great deal for work when I was very visibly pregnant and also as a new mother, my takeaway is this. Almost the only ones who sympathize with you, who stop to help you, who see you at all, are other mothers. To everyone else, you are at best invisible, at worst an obstacle that makes security lines slow and plane rides noisy. It barely needs to be said that society thinks of motherhood and pregnancy, to the extent it thinks of them at all, with impatience and irritation. Society does not view childbearing in that way, but I can imagine a version of feminism that would say it ought to. A version of feminism that says that pregnant women perform a very hard, vitally important task, a task that demands a great deal, a task that no one else can do, a task that they do not because that is all they are good for, but in spite of the fact that they are also capable of so much else, just as all those promising young people put everything else on hold to defend their country. This sounds feminist to me, but I don't think it is a view that many contemporary feminists hold, because it is a view that makes sense only if it actually is vitally important to take up the burden of caring for unborn life. It is a view that makes sense only to the extent that unborn life matters. Only to the extent that when you find yourself entrusted with that life, you really are required to put everything else on the back burner. If you are not, if caring for that life is a burden to be taken on only if the timing works out, or only if a child is something you happen to want, then there's no reason for society to treat pregnant women as heroes. If the life of an unborn child doesn't matter, and if you take on the burden of caring for it anyway, more fool you. So at the end of the day, this is my conclusion. Yes, you can be feminist and pro-life, but you will at worst have to concede that your moral framework constricts your feminism. At best, though, your moral framework may lead you to understand feminism in a different way altogether.
Do you want to open it to questions now?
Sure.
Yeah. So I have a question. So you talk about maybe a different version of feminism, but why not scrap the feminism view altogether? Why not say this is a political movement that's become something that I can't quite agree with a wider moral framework, and maybe we should try to adopt something that's just different than that?
So let me rephrase what you're asking and see, and you can tell me if it's still the same question you asked.
Sure.
Your question, as I understand it, is this. I'm talking about ways in which you can be pro-life and a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying, why bother? You're right. So maybe feminism is just dumb, and maybe we just need to forget about it.
Kind of, yeah.
Let me think about what I want to say here. I mean, I think the answer to that question is gonna depend on what you mean by feminism in part. Okay. Because the view that I'm advocating towards the end of the paper is to say that women really are capable and valuable and have a lot to contribute to society, but they also have a special ability, namely to care for unborn life, and that matters too, right? And so I'm kind of proposing a version of feminism under which women are both very capable and also have special obligations in virtue of the special things that they are capable of. Okay. I don't see anything particularly objectionable in that, right? In that understanding of feminism. Now, there's something else that you could be saying or could be hinting at, which is to say that the feminism that there's a certain kind of feminism that you don't like and think that maybe should be scrapped. Is that kind of what you have in mind, or
right, more of that, like the feminism that decided that the pro-life feminists weren't allowed at the march, and maybe that's what's become the prevailing idea of feminism, so maybe we just don't want to deal with that.
Well, I guess what I was saying, I mean, I think that when I first heard about this, I thought that the feminists who, when I first heard about the women, the sponsorship getting revoked, I thought it was just like the feminist version of Mean Girls, right? Like, you can't be part of our party. But the more I thought about it, the more, if feminism really is committed to this view that women should not be asked to bear burdens that the rest of society are not, if that's the view and you're willing to go toe-to-toe for that, then I think it actually does, that version of feminism actually does translate over to a view that you have to support access to abortion. I think it does. What I'm proposing we add to the mix is that being equal and being valuable and being capable doesn't mean not being asked to bear burdens. Like, that's what I think we need to add to the mix, right? It's the value of the unborn life that women carry, right? If that's also valuable, and if that's something that only we can do, then I think it's valuable to ask us to carry it. But I guess what I'm saying is that I think that there's a version of the feminist argument, I don't agree with it, but I think it's coherent in a way that I didn't initially think, right? Because if you are committed to the idea that it is unfair that women have to bear a burden that men don't, right, then that is going to translate to the view that you have to be able to rid yourself of that burden. I think that's a coherent view. And I think that if you want, now you can say, well, I don't want to be a feminist, and that's one way off the boat, right? But if you want to affirm that women are equal and are valuable, then you have to find a way around that problem. I don't know if I'm answering your question very well.
I think you are. It makes sense.
So you had an analogy that uses the Second World War, right, and suggests that the draft is, you know, number one, that it's involuntary, which is problematic, because there are many steps along the way of the draft in which you can get yourself out of it. Now, and the easy thing to say about that is the draft in itself also is not inherently good or bad. It is perceived as good in the Second World War because the effort is perceived as noble. We can easily compare the draft in Vietnam and show large discontent with the same exact process that went through the First World War and the Second World War and worked just fine in the Vietnam War, but there was widespread discontent by your own recognition that we view this as invaluable. So is the question one of, it seems that maybe there's an incongruence between feminism and value that you're identifying. So, in other words, if feminism proposes to say that a woman is valuable, but a woman is only valuable if she does not do what a woman does, is this equality or valuing women? So if the equality of woman is to do everything that a man does that value a woman? Or if I don't believe that bearing children is a valuable thing, so then even bigger than this, if children themselves are the burden upon society, then is feminism even the, is it even the cause, or is it just a symptom? Is feminism experiencing a symptom of a broader thing that suggests that women have no value, men have no value, people have no value, so therefore, it's whether I determine that life has value or not about the aims of anything that I'm looking to do. So i.e. just like the draft. No, the Vietnam War has no value. Therefore, the draft has no value, right?
I want to say two things. Because I think you're raising, I think, two potentially different points. I mean, you link them together, but you're raising, on the one hand, the potential incongruity with the example of the draft, or the fact that we viewed the draft differently in different situations. One where we viewed the cause as valuable, then we supported it. When we weren't so sure about the value of the cause, we didn't support it.
Correct.
Right? And then the second question you're raising are kind of what the things we value mean for how we understand feminism. I think that's the second thing you're raising.
Centrally, I'm looking at the question of value.
Right, yeah, right? You're essentially, yeah. So one preliminary point, I think one can respect the idea that one ought to honor the call to defend one's country in its own right. So that when you are called upon to stand up in defense of your country, you ought to do it. Except perhaps in an unjust cause, right? That wouldn't actually be a genuine call to honor your country, right? So I think it's possible that somebody, for instance, called up in the draft in Vietnam, right, might very much respect the idea that they did have an obligation to honor their country and to defend it. But in that particular case, also think that they were being asked to do something immoral and unjust, and they would have to navigate that. But what I'm trying to separate here is kind of the idea that I do have the burden from the deep particular details of this particular situation.
Sure, or one might, we must value that burden. So I guess the point then becomes
value.
So if I don't value it, is it a burden? In other words, like, you're bearing something that should not be borne. Pun intended.
I guess so one thing that I want to concede before I go down that route, I do think that the feminist who wants to be pro-life has to understand feminism in a completely different way. I think it has to mean something entirely different. My complaint against the pro-life feminist movement is that they try to be too identical with existing feminist movement. That's my complaint. I don't think it's the same thing. I think you understand what it is to be a woman differently. I think you understand the obligations that women have differently. I think there's an entirely different understanding at work there. And I think that nobody is helped by an attempt to gloss it over and pretend that there aren't real differences there. That's kind of the point that is motivating all of this, I think. With that said, yeah, I do agree that it is a difference in what you value. But what I'm kind of hesitant to agree to, and I'm not sure that this is actually what you're saying, is that something becomes right or not, or burdensome or not, based on what you perceive to be the value of what you're doing. Because I do think it's possible that you could have a view about what's right and not necessarily see the value in it yet, if that makes any sense, right? That's a point I was trying to make about the women who find pregnancy burdensome. I think many women who choose to carry their pregnancies to term do not see any value in being pregnant right now or having this child right now. There are lots of other, but they do it because they think it's right. And they think that they've been entrusted with a life and it's theirs to care for. And I think many people who go to war do not see any value, at least for themselves, in going to war or in taking up this burden, but they do it because they think it's the right thing to do. And maybe when you're using the word value, you're linking it with the right thing to do, and not I can see for myself the goodness of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, so value doesn't have to be selfish.
Right.
right?
Right.
And so if all value is built on my own transaction, then that's perhaps part of the problem.
Right.
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 So in
right. And this, I mean, the sorts of things I'm talking about here require the recognition of a value with a capital V, so to speak, right? Beyond what I can see. Yeah. No, I agree with that.
So, I mean, following along with the parallel to the draft, would this view of feminism that you're proposing, women as heroes bearing burden only they can bear, which I agree with, does that also force us to view further obligations on the rest of society? So during the draft, when the young, strong, able-bodied men went off to war, then there were the war efforts back home, the Victory Gardens, things
absolutely.
Of that nature that showed the rest of society had an obligation to these heroes. So then if women are viewed in the same light,
absolutely.
Then we should, that requires further lobbying for those
absolutely.
Services and health programs
absolutely.
And things like that, that other current feminists would argue for.
Absolutely. Right, it's a different way of arguing.
Yes.
Right, but I think it absolutely falls. Right, if you okay. really do value women and you really do think that they have something vitally important to offer,
mm-hmm.
And you also think that they that children are vitally important,
mm-hmm.
right, then you're going to try and find ways for women to have careers and be mothers, right? Because you value their contributions to the workforce, you also value their contributions as mothers, right? So I think it does require that the rest of society support women in all of the ways that contemporary feminists are arguing for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely it does. I think a colleague of mine, we were talking about this idea, a colleague of mine sent me a few pages from a history book about ancient Greece, the Greek way of life. And it's very interesting. In ancient Sparta, I never knew this, but in ancient Sparta, you know, people who died in battle got special military honors. And they got their names inscribed in a special. So did women who died in childbirth. Isn't that interesting? I mean, imagine if we gave women who died in childbirth the same kind of funerary honors that we gave people who died in battle. But there was a recognition there, right, that these women were doing something very important and putting their lives on the line, right? So there's a value. I absolutely think that's the case, right?
So then you can make a lot of allies that way on the
you
other
could.
Side.
You could.
Possibly.
Yeah. I think the sticking point is going to be the claim that the child's life, that I think the sticking point is that you can have obligations that you didn't sign up for and didn't ask for. But I think that's the sticking point.
I hope this makes sense. It's kind of floating around in my brain. So the way I understand your argument is that the ideal pro-life feminist view would be to, the way we approach that is kind of an appeal to the sacrifice and the burden, so to speak, that women bear that is heroic of pregnancy. So then, like, on the other hand, you have the advent of better workplace policies that make pregnancy and childbirth less of a burden, so to speak. So, like, wouldn't we be, which I think are a very good thing, and
yeah,
like, I hope to
no,
see
I
those.
See what you're saying. Yeah,
wouldn't
I
that
see
somehow
what you're
undercut
saying.
Our ability to appeal to the burdensome nature of pregnancy and childbirth as, like, the value?
Yeah, I think part of what I'm saying here, well, this is part of, regardless of whether it's part of what I was trying to say here, it's what I think. I don't think any amount of maternity leave measures are ever going to alleviate the burdens of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Pregnancy is a disruption in your life, and it's going to require you to put plans on hold and to give up your dreams, and it's going to make you worse at your job for a certain amount. It just does. If you know, it is, and no amount of we're giving you paid time off or what? No amount of that is ever going to alleviate that burden, any more than the GI Bill is ever going to alleviate the sacrifice of fighting in battle, right? I mean, there are measures that we take to try to recompense it, but it's a real, it's a hard thing, right? And I think that we need to, that those of us who oppose abortion need to recognize that we are asking something hard of people. And it's there's not any kind of compensation that's ever gonna undo the difficulty of what we're asking. We're asking for sacrifice, right? And so, yeah, I like that point. But I guess I don't think that those burden alleviating measures are going to really fill the gap.
I appreciate very much to find interesting there's a logical congruency between feminism and the pro-choice argument, and your if I understood the last point that you were making is that the pro-life feminists have to kind of approach feminism in a different way. I guess the question that's been sticking in my mind has been on the issue of equality itself.
Mm-hmm.
Is your contention that seeing feminism in a different way necessitates that there is a higher ideal or perhaps a different valuation that takes primacy over equality? There's a limitation on equality itself that makes the pro-choice version of feminism, while logically consistent, inherently weaker than the pro-life version.
So the equality thing is something I kind of glossed over. It's a subject of a great deal of feminist literature. For those of you who, probably some of you are aware that people talk about waves of feminism, right? And one of the things that's that kind of contemporary feminists kind of poo-poo is the second wave notion of equality, right? Where equality was understood to be sameness, right? Sameness between men and women. And most, as I understand, most contemporary feminists don't believe in the sameness view of equality, right? That say so. They believe that equality has to mean something different than identity of opportunity, and what exactly it means is still ambiguous. I think that it's open to me to take advantage of that ambiguity, and kind of embrace the idea that equal doesn't have to mean the same, right? So that perhaps equal could mean embracing all of the things that women can do, while also embracing all of the things that men can do without demanding that they be the same as each other. But I think even feminists, I guess the Cliff Notes version of my response is I think even feminists acknowledge that the equality is not going to be the way forward. In the sense that this appears in contemporary feminist writing, many contemporary feminists argue that the way forward, the way to defend abortion is not the right to privacy, as Roe v. Wade was based on, right? But the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution, right? So that the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution has been used to defend, say, demanding handicapped access to buildings, right? Because the idea is that the handicapped don't really have an access to a job if they can't get in the building, right? And so contemporary feminists have argued that that's why abortion is necessary, right? Because women don't have access to the same things if they can't become unpregnant because they might not be able to take the job, promotion, or whatever. I think it's interesting to notice that use of equality doesn't actually rely on the sameness. It only highlights the discrepancy between the two. Sorry, that's a long answer.
If that's all the questions we have for now.
I'm not sure how to view this. I understand that there is a moral belief that life begins at whatever point you want to choose it. But even aside from that, are pro-choice feminists, and I'm not asking you to speak for all of them, what is their view of what they are aborting? Is this just not a human being and therefore it doesn't matter? Is this a potential human? Is it a human being? Like,
the view of Judith Jarvis Thompson, at least, right, she's the one that I mentioned in this paper, is that it doesn't matter. That the fetus could have the same rights that you have, and it still would be okay to procure an abortion because you did not ask to be saddled with that burden. Right? So that other people don't have to go around feeding and housing somebody for 9 months at the expense of their life. They shouldn't have to. They wouldn't be doing anything wrong or unjust in refusing that burden. And similarly, a woman, even if her child has all the rights in the world and is as much of a person as they are, if the woman didn't sign up for that burden voluntarily, then it should not be demanded of her. That's Thompson's view, right? So Thompson's view is that she doesn't necessarily think it, but she's willing to concede for the sake of argument that what you're aborting is a being with the same right to life that you have. She just doesn't think you owe it anything.
So to what extent do you think the Thomistic Institute's role in theology play in this? I mean, this is a rejection of most basic theologies. At that point, to say that another life doesn't have a matter, I basically rejected any recognizable Judeo-Christian and even Islamic theology at that point.
You're rejecting, I think your question is important. One thing that I think it's important to emphasize is that you don't have to be a theologian to think that abortion is immoral. I think that's very important, right? You can think that other people's lives impose burdens on you without being a Christian or without having any particular view. Now, certainly, if you are a Christian, then you do think other people's lives impose burdens on you, right? But one thing that irritates me is when people assume that the only reasons for opposing abortion are theological ones. In my mind, abortion comes down to two questions, right? Is this a person, right? Is this a life that has value? And do I have obligations to other people that I perhaps didn't ask for or didn't want?
But in the last argument, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because I didn't ask for this burden, therefore it's not a burden.
Right.
Therefore it is a life. Therefore I can terminate it for what reason?
Because on Thompson's view, because I did not agree to be so burdened.
What makes that moral?
I don't think it is a moral view. But I guess my response to you is I don't think you have to be a Christian to think that view is immoral. That's my response. Right? I don't think that it's only a theologian who would say, I have burdens I didn't sign up for. I think anybody who lives in a community, anybody who is in a family, anybody who loves another human being sees that they can be burdened in ways they didn't ask to be burdened and that they have obligations they didn't sign up for. So the only thing I was resisting in your point was the jump to the theology. I don't think that you need a theological argument to make the argument that you have burdens you didn't sign up for. I agree that if you jump to theology, then you have plenty of other reasons to think that you have burdens you didn't sign up for. But I don't think you have to, right? Because what irritates me is when a reporter calls me on the phone at the Catholic University of America and assumes that all of my arguments against abortion are theological ones, when none of them are, right? I have a certain view about justice. I have a certain view about what we owe other people. Though they happen to coincide very nicely with my religious beliefs, but they're not particularly religious beliefs.